Hi, welcome to Indiana Weekend with John Strauss. This is a kind of radio magazine show about the interesting places and intriguing people in our part of the state. We're always interested in your thoughts. Drop us a note at indianaweekend@gmail.com with your suggestions and comments. Let us know what's going on where you are. There was a bit of news last week that slipped into the mix amid the rush of the holidays, 3 days after Christmas. Sunday, December 28th, marked the formal end of the U.S. combat mission in Afghanistan. President Barack Obama said that after 13 years, the longest war in American history was coming to a responsible conclusion. Counting both Afghanistan and Iraq, more than 2.5 million U.S. military personnel have been deployed to war since 2001. Dave Vesper, a high school science teacher and administrator, has been there 3 times. He's a colonel in the Indiana National Guard, and we talked with him in 2013 at University High School in Carmel.
2 tours in Afghanistan and 1 tour in Iraq. In 2004, 2005, when I was in Afghanistan for a year, where I was embedded in the Afghan army, helped train them, patrol with them during the initial Afghan elections. Then in 2008, I was in Iraq, where I commanded a base in northern Iraq, and then was also a battalion commander where my units did convoy security around northern Iraq. And then in 2012, I was in Afghanistan again, and I was a brigade executive officer, so helping manage staff for a unit that was managing all the coalition presence in a province. And then I also got to mentor then the chief of police for a couple of months of the province I was in.
So when you first went 2004 in Afghanistan, we at that point had driven the Taliban out, right?
Yeah, at that point, the Taliban as a political force wasn't controlling any more territory, but you still had a country that was fundamentally fragmented. So there was no central government in Kabul, and what we were there for was to be embedded in the new Afghan army. So a new central army working for the central government, and in my case, we were patrolling in eastern Afghanistan. So we had a battalion of Afghans that we were worked with, and we both helped them with training and standards and also served as liaisons between them and coalition forces. So we would patrol jointly with U.S. Marines, for instance, at times, and would coordinate with the other U.S. forces, and that was our role. And then we'd also, again, work with the Afghans, help them get to move beyond a militia-type force or a guys that used to work for warlords to a force that is providing security for the people on behalf of a central government.
So how did that play out as you're there, in effect, trying to build a professional force from something that didn't exist before?
Yeah, it was a transition, especially in 2004, 2005, because there was not yet a technical government, an autonomous government. President Karzai had not been elected. That happened while we were there. But I remember the first time one of the first times we were patrolling with a battalion, we went to a local militia compound where we knew some weapons were being stored to be turned in on behalf of the UN. And the local militia there drew all their weapons and said, "Who are you guys?" And we're like, "Hey, we're the Afghan National Army." And it's like, "What are you talking about? There is no Afghan National Army." And had to explain that, no, we're from Kabul and this is actually your government. And then people 2 months later, were quite happy to see us waving and, you know, moving us through. But initially, they had no idea that their central government was pushing out. It was just the next basically set of armed people coming through the area from their point of view.
What is it like coming back to the classroom, to a school like this, after what you've been through?
Sure, there's certainly a level of alertness that comes with that. Now, I was fortunate enough to not have to be, did not get injured, but certainly saw things blowing up. And I know when my wife complained when I first got back, I'd be driving around 465. And to be honest, I didn't notice it so much, but I was changing lanes back and forth when there was stuff on the side of the road. It's prudent. And whenever there's something on the side of the road, you would normally swing around it. But I was probably doing it a little more deliberately and a little quicker than what would be considered normal. So I think there's a normal tension, and a lot of soldiers, I think, feel that when they come back. Not tension, but tenseness and an alertness that takes some time to ramp back down.
Was there a time when something went off and you were nearby?
Certainly pretty normal in Iraq and in Afghanistan. And normal can vary depending where people are, to once a week to once a month to daily, I think, in some people, for some people's experience. And certainly, again, that sets you on edge. I know when I came back the first 4th of July, my wife would talk about she could see the tension in me as we were watching fireworks. And if I thought about it, yes, I was sitting up quite erect and feeling quite alert about the fireworks going off, even though I know perfectly well it's just fireworks going off. Overall, it's really good. I get a lot of experiences that I can share in my classes. I normally teach physics and astronomy. That's my background. But since going to Afghanistan the first time, I've taught a couple classes on failed states, reconstruction, just based on all my experiences working with NGOs, working with the UN, working with the State Department, in interfacing with them while I was working with the Afghan army or the Afghan police. And that gave me a perspective on something that, you know, when I was in school, I wasn't all that interested in, but now I have a lot of interest in, and so I can teach about that. And I also can guest lecture in some of the history classes when they talk, or even the literature classes when they're reading Afghan literature.
I wondered, since Dave Vesper had, two tours in Afghanistan, the last one ending just last year, what progress he had seen in that time?
Yeah, certainly in the first deployment, when I was working with a battalion, there are two things that stood out. So I'm working with an Afghan battalion, and thinking back 3 months into it about when we first got there, and the locals are pulling out weapons when they see us because they don't recognize us, and then 3 months later having I'm doing a foot patrol through Jalalabad and having locals come up, and I'm chatting with them, and they're talking about how they're happy when they see the army because at that point they felt very comfortable when they were around. They knew there were still people with guns, there were still bad guys, but they were happy when an army people were nearby because they felt safe. That was a success. And when we just saw more trade going on, you'd see trucks going back, and then toward the end of our time there, there was a road was finally built. There was a bunch of international money to help build a main highway between Kabul and Jalalabad. And you see trade going back and forth. And, you know, if trade is going, that means money is exchanging hands. There may be corruption. There may be, you know, graft going on. But trade means new resources for people. And going back 7 years later, despite all the continued fighting, despite what is seen by a lot of setbacks, just going through the city, at that point I was based in Tarinkot, and going into a city and seeing almost all the roads are paved, and being paved by Afghans in part, that there are people that are functioning. There are judges who are judging cases for people that are in jail.
There's a rule of law, not just of warlords.
Yeah, I mean, fundamentally I'm an optimistic guy. But I think that has to be, you have to be prudent about what your expectations are. I think historically, insurgencies last around 10 years. That's normal. And if you look at a country like Afghanistan and the devastation, I think a reasonable expectation anytime in the near future is a perfectly normal, stable, poor third world nation. That is high success.
Colonel David Vesper of the Indiana National Guard, who served two tours of duty in Afghanistan and one in Iraq, and someone we wanted to talk with as the United States formally ended its combat mission in Afghanistan last week. We talked with Colonel Vesper in 2013 at University High School in Carmel, where he is a science teacher and assistant principal. About 2,200 American troops were killed in Afghanistan in a war that cost the U.S. $1 trillion since the initial invasion in 2001. Colonel Vesper said his concern is that many who have returned are having trouble getting good jobs after their service.
Indiana Weekend, real radio from just down the road. You can look for that name on Facebook and drop us a line. Let us know what you think at indianaweekend@gmail.com. Now here's John Strauss.
This winter is off to a pretty mild start overall. You know, fairly warm, not too much snow. Of course, as soon as I say that, we'll get a blizzard headed this way. But mild weather is a rare gift in the winter, so it's no surprise that this is the slowest time of the year for festivals around the state. Not much listed at the Indiana State Festivals Association. At the state's official site, meanwhile, you can find a few things. Park County Maple Syrup Fair at the end of February. Also in February, the Kokomo Chocolate Celebration and the Shipshawana Pajama Sale. You can find the entire 2015 festival guide at the state's tourism website, visitindiana.com. In Richmond, meanwhile, it looks like the city's new ice festival, just started last year, will be back at the end of this month. Great chance to watch chainsaw-wielding ice carvers in action. We'll have more on that in a minute, but first, a winter event that may surprise you because of its growing popularity, eagle watching in Indiana. At a time of year when things are kind of slow in many outdoor venues, at least 3 eagle watching events are scheduled this month. You can see the birds at Patoka Lake on January 10th. A week later on the 17th, it's the Sunrise Eagle Watch at Mississinewa Lake. And Turkey Run State Park has its Eagles in Flight weekend at the end of this month. Unfortunately, one of the best Eagle events is canceled this year because of construction at the Duke Energy Cayuga Power Plant, about 35 miles north of Terre Haute. Hundreds of people come there each year at a scenic spot on a bend in the river. We visited one time and talked with Daniel Arndt, an environmental scientist for the company. We also check in with a couple of guys who came out, but we'll start with Daniel.
Well, right now we're looking at the warm water discharge from Cayuga Station into Wabash River. And normally we get juvenile and mature bald eagles that nest in around the trees right near the discharge.
And so these eagles live around here, or are they coming from somewhere else?
Yes and no. We do have a lot of nests around Sugar Creek and the Wabash River, so we do have some residents, but also they do migrate from up north because, you know, as the water freezes, open water's available. Up there's not, is gone, and so they're looking for open water, and they come here and find it.
It really turned out pretty nice. In fact, I'm a little too warm.
My name's Frank Hoak, and I'm from Clinton, Indiana.
Tell me what kind of luck you've had in spotting the eagles today.
Well, they've got this one here spotted right out. It's on the bend of the river right there. So that's the only one we've been seen setting so far.
You come out here every year?
No, this is my first year, although I live in the area. And in the summertime, we do the Sugar Creek trip with the canoes. And you can see them in the summertime on the Sugar Creek.
Eagles are kind of bird you don't see every day.
Oh, no, not around here, that's for sure. So we're lucky they're nesting in this area.
How many eagles might there be around here this time of year, attracted by the fishing opportunities?
I'd say around 100 or more. We think we've seen on really harsh winter days up to 30 or 40 out here.
And because on those real harsh winter days, this is the space where there'd be some water where they can get the fish.
Yes, especially with the warm water discharge, it attracts a fish from the river to congregate around that area because it gives them a refugia. And so you concentrate the food, you get habitat, you get a remote area, you get eagles.
I don't remember as a kid where we would see stuff like this.
The eagles, not as when we were kids, the eagles weren't around. They just been reintroduced to this area, and they're starting to thrive.
And for folks who have not had a chance to see that, describe that a little bit.
Well, I mean, you can. It's one of the wonders of the world. I mean, you can see this stuff on TV, but until you see one in person, when you see one up close, you see one in the wild, it's just breathtaking.
And you bring your own spotting scope here?
I got a pair of binoculars that's older than I am. So that's what I bring.
Eagles were endangered at one point, right? What's happened there?
Yes, they were listed in 1978 as federally endangered. And then, so that act prevented illegal taking of the eagles themselves and their habitat. And then in 2007, they were delisted as federally endangered. And now I think they're listed as species of special concern.
Now, what do most people not realize about the bald eagle?
I would say that their numbers are so high. I mean, you know, I know back then it was kind of a rare thing to see a bald eagle, but now, especially with my work on the Wabash River, I see several while I'm out, you know, conducting the sampling. So I think just the availability to see them and the numbers.
Can you tell me your name? Where are you from?
Troy Hauer. I'm from Terre Haute, Indiana.
So have you had any luck today? Have you seen some of the birds?
Yeah, seen a couple.
Tell me about that.
Got one sitting over here on the left side and one way out there. Both adults got the white head and everything.
And do you get to see them fishing? Do you get to see them?
Right now they're just sitting. They said earlier that there's some out there flying around, but right now they're just sitting.
Do you come here every year for this?
This is about my third year. Not every year, but we come quite often.
And do you get to see them each time?
Oh, yeah. Seen eagles every time.
This time of year, this is a good opportunity to get out of the house.
Oh, yes, definitely. And the weather today is beautiful. Been here before when it's been very cold and you can't even stand it, but this year is really nice.
When you come out here, what do you get to see the eagles doing? Usually they're sitting in a tree or?
I've seen them flying year to year. I've seen them actually dive into the river. They're majestic. I mean, that's why they're our, you know, national bird. I mean, they're beautiful.
You're a scientist. Is there a piece of this, though, where you go, gosh, that sure is a nice-looking bird? I mean, there comes a time, I would imagine, when you're looking at it as a scientist, but you're also saying, man, I'm really seeing something here.
Yeah, I just, to me, it's as a scientist, it's just cool to see their recovery story. I think DNR did a survey in 2010, and they saw around 110 eagle nests. So just the recovery story and how conservation efforts really do work.
The eagle's hunting ability stems from keen eyesight.
Yeah, yeah, they can locate their prey up to 2 miles away, and so these are keen eyesight mainly. They don't really have a good sense of smell, so it's really that they're strong flyers. They live pretty long, so you know it's really keen eyesight and then experience as they learn to fish.
Did you see that crazy viral video that came out a few weeks ago? The baby in the park, the eagle swoops.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, I think that I saw that and got a chuckle, honestly, but it was a hoax, I believe.
Yeah, it was a hoax. As a biologist, when you saw that, did you go, wait a minute, no way?
Yeah, I mean, I was kind of, I know, you know, golden eagles are large and can carry large prey items, but, they don't really tolerate human activity that much. So just to have one come in a park, you know, with all those people, you're like, wait a minute.
That wasn't going to happen.
Yeah, and plus, you know, on the internet, you know, you never know what's true and what's not.
But do you have to, should you be careful if you have a cat or something, and a small dog in the backyard? Is that something that these birds could conceivably go after? Or?
Conceivably, yes. Especially kind of immature eagles, once they first leave the nest, they haven't really learned how to fish yet, and they're looking for, usually they scavenge, so there's actually one of the eagles there at the Eagle Foundation was living in somebody's backyard, so, you know, if you do have a resident eagle in your backyard, there's that possibility, but I don't think it's likely.
That's Daniel Arndt, an environmental scientist for Duke Energy at the company's annual Bald Eagle Viewing Day at its Cayuga Power Plant along the Wabash River, 35 miles north of Terre Haute. They had to cancel this year because of a big construction project, but you can find details on the other eagle viewing opportunities on the Indiana Department of Natural Resources website or on our Indiana Public Radio Facebook page. Coming up, a winter event that is definitely on this year, ice and chainsaws in Richmond.
This is Indiana Weekend with John Strauss here on Indiana Public Radio.
My name is Bill Thistlewaite, and I'm the superintendent of Parks and Recreation in Richmond, Indiana. And we're one of the sponsors for the Richmond Meltdown Ice Festival coming at the last weekend in January. This will be our second Richmond Meltdown. It's a winter ice festival that a group of ice carvers have kind of put together and taken their show on the road here in the last 4 or 5 years to kind of promote not only their profession, but to also to bring a lot of interest and people and business into town in the middle of the winter, which is kind of unusual when you have a festival in January.
What do people see at these?
They see a lot of different ice carvings that these guys can do. These ice carvers that we use are all professional ice carvers. When I say professional, that's what they do for a living. That's all they do for a living is carve ice. And I'm sure people have seen ice sculptures for weddings and logos for conventions and that kind of thing. You know, these guys take their talent and jack it up a couple notches and do almost anything in ice. We're going to do two different areas, a couple things this year. We do an interactive area where we have a slide that the kids can slide on. And we have ski ball, ping pong table made out of ice. Have a throne that's a real big picture opportunity. And stuff that's very interactive. And then we're also this year planning on doing a life-size Model T that people can sit in and get their pictures taken, since Richmond is the home to the National Model T Museum.
When we say ice carving, we're talking about chainsaws, right?
We're talking chainsaws and all kinds of power tools like you've never seen before. And even go back to, they still use the good old-fashioned, you know, chisel to do a lot of it too.
Yeah, and you have a competition, right, where some of the carvers face off.
Ice carving, the finished product is beautiful. It's a It's a sculpture that sits there and it's just kind of glistens. But it's kind of boring to watch these guys just do this for 3 or 4 hours to make. So what we've done is come up with a show which we call Ice Fights, which is kind of patterned after a boxing match or something like that, and where we have 3 15-minute rounds, one carver against the other carver, and they come up with a really unique sculpture in 45 minutes, and then the winner is decided by the crowd.
There are not a whole lot of festivals going on this time of year, so this is an opportunity for Richmond, for example, to get people in to take a look at the place.
It certainly is. It's and that's the one. The reason we do these like we do is to try to promote the city. We got a group of ice carvers that obviously want to make some money, so they come in. But our main focus is, what can we do to bring people into the city? So that's the thing we kind of do. That's our focus. But on a really slow time of year, this usually ends up being some of these businesses, especially food establishments, their biggest day of the year, and it comes in the middle or late in January, which is pretty unusual.
I think your son is one of these ice carvers, right?
he certainly is.
How did this come about? Did you know at an early age he was going to be a chainsaw artist?
I didn't know he was going to be a chainsaw artist, but I knew that he always had a lot of artistic ability, and so he started out, and all these guys come from a culinary background. My son was an executive chef at a country club, and that's where he basically learned how to carve ice. And they just take it to another level. All these guys were in the culinary profession.
For people who've not been to Richmond for a while, you have some things to see there.
We got lots of things to see. Like I said before, we have the National Model Team Museum. It's a great antique area. Richmond is the home to, first home to recorded jazz. So we have a lot of different things that promote that.
And is one of your parks around a ravine of some kind? I seem to recall taking a walk.
Yes, the Whitewater Gorge, and that's the old Star Jeanette area down there. That's where the Star Jeanette area and their Walk of Fame is down through this gorge. And the gorge runs through the entire city of Richmond.
Bill Thistlewaite, Richmond Parks and Recreation Department Superintendent. That city's meltdown Winter Ice Festival had been in danger of being canceled, but they lined up an extra $4,500 in sponsorships and donations. You can find details at richmondmeltdown.com or check on our Facebook page here at Indiana Weekend. And that, festival fans, is our show for today. I'm John Strauss. Big thanks to our producer, Sean Ashcraft. Glad you could join us this time and hope you'll stay in touch. Drop me a note at indianaweekend@gmail.com if you would like more information or have a suggestion. In the meantime, thanks and have a great week until we meet again on the next Indiana Weekend on Indiana Public Radio.
Indiana Weekend with host John Strauss. Our show is engineered at Indiana Public Radio, produced by Sean Ashcraft. Major support for Indiana Weekend comes from Dillman's Furniture of Muncie, serving East Central Indiana with home furnishings from Flex Steel, Bassett, and Simmons Beauty Rest. Join us again next week for Indiana Weekend with John Strauss here on Indiana Public Radio.